What does it take to promote democracy here at home?
All of us need to step up so that more and more all of us can feel that we have a voice, that human beings need to know that we have a voice that is power, that we also have meaning in our lives and a connection to others so that we're all feeling like we are respected, we have dignity.
That's Frances Moore LaPay of the Small Planet Institute. We talk with her and co-author Adam Eichen about their new book, Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. Then, Adam Eichen is joined by Rabbi Michael Pollack to talk about a democracy initiative going on right now in Pennsylvania. That's all coming up on today's Writer's Voice. Thanks for joining us this hour on this station and at writersvoice.net. I'm your host, Francesca Rianna. It's hard to be optimistic about our democracy these days. As our president muses about becoming president for life, our election system is under attack from those who seek to suppress the vote or hack it, and oligarchic forces seem to have captured large portions of our government. It's tempting to give way to despair. But my guests Frances Moore LaPay and Adam Eichen say it's not the magnitude of the challenge to our democracy that can crush our spirit. It's feeling powerless, in this case, fearing that to stand up for democracy is futile. Their book, Daring Democracy, is a welcome antidote to despair. On the one hand, it demystifies how we got here by exposing the well-orchestrated effort that's robbed Americans of our rightful power. But it also explores solutions that Americans are fighting for right now. Even in this divisive time, people are uniting across causes and ideologies to create a canopy of hope that the authors call the democracy movement. In this invigorating movement of movements, millions of Americans are leaving despair behind as they push for and achieve historic change. The movement and democracy itself are vital to us as citizens and fulfill our human needs for power, meaning, and connection, so essential to all of us. Frances Moore LaPay founded the Small Planet Institute after the global success of her books about vegetarianism, starting with the hugely influential Diet for a Small Planet. In recent years, the Institute has broadened out from its work on sustainable food and agriculture to promoting democracy. Organizer Adam Eichen has joined Frances Moore LaPay in that effort. I spoke with them in February, just after producing the episode of Writer's Voice featuring my conversation with Daniel Ellsberg about the threat of nuclear war. You can find that interview about his book, The Doomsday Machine, at writersvoice.net. It was much on my mind when I spoke with Frances Moore LaPay and Adam Eichen. Frances Moore LaPay and Adam Eichen, welcome back to Writer's Voice.
Thank you.
Thank you. Great to be here.
You know, I have to say that yesterday I was very, very depressed because I was editing an interview with Daniel Ellsberg about the Doomsday Machine. Just absolutely terrifying. And then today I was preparing my questions about your wonderful book, Daring Democracy, and my mood completely shifted. You quote somebody right in the beginning of the book saying, "It's way too late for pessimism." What do you mean by that?
Well, we love that. Yes, D-Hawk, it's far too late and things are far too bad for pessimism. And that is that hope has power and we need all that power. So we call ourselves possibilists. We can't be optimist in this time. We certainly don't want to be pessimist. So possibility is what we're talking about in this book, that it's not possible to know what's possible. Human beings and even Americans, yes, us, we have made enormous strides throughout our history when citizens have come together who believed in democracy for all of us. And this is one of those times where make it or break it, and more people are super excited about jumping in to save and to enrich our democracy.
And just on that topic, we were recording this right now, right after a weekend in New Orleans, where we attended the inaugural Unrig the System Summit, where there were about 1,500 people there who were ready to fight for our democracy. And it was it was really an exciting experience, being with so many people who had a sense of possibility that we really can make our system work for every American, not just those with money.
And I want to add here that hope, when I said hope has power, I didn't mean that just in some mushy kind of spiritual sense, although I like those things too. That hope actually reorganizes our brains toward solutions. And so it is extremely important. It's not soft. It's really a key to our progress.
Now, one thing is, you know, so many people say that Americans are divided, that we are divided against each other, but you push back against that frame. Why?
Well, yes, we push hard because on the fundamentals of democracy, we are in vast agreement across all sectors of society. 85% of us believe that we need a real deep redo of our funding of political campaigns. Yeah, go ahead.
Yeah, 80% of us think that the wealthy have too much influence, and 75% of us feel that they themselves have, or you know, that people have too little influence in Washington, D.C., essentially saying that they feel powerless. They feel like they do not have a political voice. So in terms of, you know, how we interpret the, you know, our democracy and our representation, Americans couldn't really be more united on this subject. And it goes to for other issues too. You know, the polling shows that we aren't a nation totally divided, that we agree on much more than we're led to believe.
I mean, even on issues, aside from these foundational questions of how we run our democracy, but even on issues that we're told that we're divided on, like climate change, remediation, correction, dealing with it, that the majority of us think that the government needs to do more to limit greenhouse gases. So that's really important to know.
It's true that in so many, I mean, even things like Medicare for All, you've got broad agreement on these kinds of things. And yet, we are profoundly, it seems, divided by some of the frames that you talk about in the book. One is a culture of blame. Talk about that.
Yes, that's really part of the pain that led us to the results of the 2016 election, that we fall for this idea in our country that we are simply selfish creatures, we human beings, and therefore our only choice is really to turn over outcomes, sorting out winners and losers to a marketplace that we're told is a free market. The problem is there's no such thing as a free market. We have a market that is largely driven by highest return to existing wealth in the immediate, you know, in the immediate future. So it's short term and it's focused on highest return to existing wealth. And that means that wealth accrues to wealth until we end up, as we do today, with three people controlling as much wealth as the bottom half of us. And yet we still hold on to this myth that the market sorts out winners and losers fairly. So, of course, it leads to people feeling humiliation and pain and loneliness if they're not feeling that they've made it in our society. And there's been a lot of blaming of poor people for their plight. So this culture of shame and blame then stands in the way of our coming together and realizing, no, we're all suffering from a lack of democracy that really sets the rules around the market and makes us all able to benefit in our economy.
And, you know, I'm sure we'll want to talk about this a little bit, but one of the claims of our book, based on the reporting of really amazing journalists like Jane Mayer and her book Dark Money, is that this system, this economy, and this broken democracy did not arise out of nowhere. Why we're at the place where we are today is because of a decades-long anti-democracy movement in our country, coordinated, deliberate, well-funded, with long-term strategy that led us to where we are today with the election of Donald Trump.
Yeah, I agree. And I do want to get more deeply into that in a moment. But just to stick with blame for a minute, aren't there people we can blame? However, what about, you know, the people who are really racist bigots who helped to elect Donald Trump? Or how about the Republican Party that has been so much behind this anti-democratic drive?
Well, I think under all of this, though, is this the pain, as I say, a feeling that if you're not making it in our society, then there's something wrong with you. And I think that infects the dialogue, infects people's hearts, and we're then told to blame the poor or people of color or immigrants. And when we feel bad about something, it's easy for human beings to look for a scapegoat. And so I think it's that culture of looking for scapegoats rather than accepting that we're all responsible. Rabbi Joshua Heschel said, some are guilty, but we're all responsible. So yes, we agree that there are some people who should be held accountable. I always go immediately to the bankers after the meltdown that could have been avoided. Yes, some of them should have gone to jail, but all of us as citizens are responsible that we didn't step up and prevent the kind of deregulation, the lowering of standards that led to that debacle that cost lives all over the planet. Is that clear that yes, some people are guilty and should be held accountable for that, but all of us need to step up and create the rules so that more and more all of us can feel that we have a voice, that human beings need to know that we have a voice that is power, that we also have meaning in our lives and a connection to others so that we're all feeling like we are respected, we have dignity.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Francis Moore-Lepe and Adam Eichen about their book, Daring Democracy. Yes, that's very clear. I mean, what you're really saying is we all have a civic responsibility to take part in our own civic life.
Exactly.
Now, you write about the frames that do create these barriers between people, some of which you've clearly already mentioned. And let's look at immigration. For example, you contrast the frame that the Canadians give to immigration with the one that's so prevalent here in the U.S. Talk about that difference.
Well, I mean, I think that it's the way you view the issues in our political system affects how we address them. And immigration is a great example that in Canada, immigration is viewed as a boon to the economy, as something that brings innovation, new culture, and new ideas. And so it's not a surprise that they let in significantly more immigrants and refugees than we do, proportionally, that is. And this goes from issue to issue, but really the way we see the world affects how we deal with the issues that arise.
And of course, the facts are the same in both countries. The facts are that immigrants give us much more than we give them, and that they add much more to the economy. We know that immigrants actually commit fewer crimes than native-borns. So all the facts are the same, that actually immigration is a net gain for us, and yet the frame here that is absorbed because it's put forth, this false frame, is that somehow we're doing a favor and that we're paying for it and they're more antisocial and dangerous than native-born, and it's just not true.
Yeah, it's interesting. I live in Eastern Long Island, and recently I saw a figure that said that immigrants contribute 18% of our economy here. And we have, this has been a huge center of anti-immigrant fervor. Those very same people who hire immigrant workers, including undocumented immigrant workers, are the ones who complain about them because they send their kids to our schools, quote unquote.
Yeah, it's just so much disinformation being put out. And again, feeding the fear and saying, blame them, rather than looking deeply at the forces. And it's what Adam was just getting at, that there are these forces that have reinforced this anti-government, pro-market, the simplistic view of the market, and ultimately the anti-immigrant, the idea of blaming, that this is something that has been deliberately fed in our culture. And that's what we've got to resist, but replace, not just resist, but replace with an understanding of what democracy really is, which is our responsibility, and not as a burden, but as an enrichment of our lives.
That goes back to your notion of hope has power, it seems to me. Sometimes I fear that the resistance movement, of which I am a part, is too much about resisting and not enough about replacing. I think, for example, Hillary Clinton saying you'll never, ever, ever get Medicare for all in this country. But already we're seeing more and more, even top politicians, jumping on that bandwagon following the positive message that Bernie Sanders gave in the campaign. So talk about that process, you know, the balance between resisting and replacing.
Well, I think, you know, that's exactly right. I think that we have to be constructive, not destructive, in terms of envisioning the society that we want. That's the only way to have long-term and sustained organizing. I mean, people consistently, you know, we go across the country, you know, speaking about this book, people, one of the most frequent questions is, I've been resisting Trump for a full year now, or I've been engaging in resistance work, and I'm feeling burnt out. And that's exactly right, that if you resist, one, eventually the thing you're resisting is going to go away, and then you stand for nothing. But then two, constantly being on the defensive and constantly not having that vision of a better society, that moral view of where we want to go, is going to lead you to be burnt out, because you have nothing subsisting your soul. You have nothing subsisting your being. And so I think that's incredibly important, to be always envisioning, and not just envisioning internally, but outspoken visualization of that future America. And this is why we framed our book, Daring Democracy, in the way that we did. That we start off with two short chapters, but with a lot of evidence about this anti-democracy movement that led us to where we are today. Because in order for us to build the better world, we need to know how we got here. That we're not just saying you need to resist this anti-democracy movement, but you have to know what strategies it used, how it did it, and what it stands for. And then the rest of our book is about the emerging democracy movement. It's 60% of our book is positive solutions, what policies we need to enact, who are the folks around the country making these policies into law, and, you know, really going into the mindset of these people who are doing more than resisting, but are creating the better world in locales, in states, and even on the national level sometimes. And I think that's the key. And that really gives us hope, because it's so underreported that there are folks doing the difficult work to create a positive future. And I think that really, for us, is one of the driving reasons that we wanted to write this book, Daring Democracy.
If you've just joined Writer's Voice, we're talking with Francis Moore LePay and Adam Eichen about their new book, Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. So let's now talk about that anti-democratic movement first. And tell us who Lewis Powell was.
Well, Lewis Powell was a corporate lawyer, pretty decent guy. He was a corporate lawyer who was very worried, almost panicky in a sense, about the threat to the business community from forces that really didn't appreciate the free enterprise system. He thought it was under threat. We're talking about the year 1971, which ironically is the same year that Diet for a Small Planet, my first book, arrived on the scene. This corporate lawyer was asked by the Chamber of Commerce to prepare a memo, a guide for how to counter this threat to the free enterprise system. Now, remember, the 60s had just been, we'd just come through the 60s, where there was tremendous progress, from my point of view, having experienced it, in the war on poverty, where we cut the rate of poverty in half in a little more than a decade. That it was the beginning of the environmental movement, with, 20 million people who turned out for the first Earth Day. It was the women's movement, and the civil rights movement had made huge strides during this decade. So there was a lot for a lot of us to celebrate. But Lewis Powell represented those who were worried about it and felt threatened.
And, you know, this memo is an outstanding piece of, it's a historical document that just really explains the course of American history post-1971. And, you know, the way this memo was interpreted basically was the roadmap for the top corporations in America and a handful of wealthy individuals. And they basically created a movement, a small anti-democracy movement that kind of mutated out of this memo. And there are two really broad strategies that we outline in the book. The first is manipulating the mindset. that basically changing the way Americans think. You know, we started this conversation off about the frames, how we view the world affects how we, you know, what solutions we bring to the table when trying to address problems. And so they try to change the frames, how we think, how we envision, you know, what are the solutions to the problems we face. And that's been done through funding of think tanks like the Heritage Foundation and the Cato Institute, by funding universities to hire certain professors that had right-wing views, monitoring textbooks for, you know, grade school students to high school students. And one of our kind of the most shocking for us, and really one of the most haunting, has been delegitimizing government itself. I mean, there's really been this long strategy to just make government not able to function. And if people don't view the government as a place for problem solving, they're much more willing to turn everything over to the free market, privatize everything. So this has gone hand in glove. It's really quite remarkable. And so, you know, I think that's a really important part about manipulating the mindset. And of course, also, just since we're, you know, talking on a wonderful community public radio, is deregulating media. You know, getting rid of the fairness doctrine and the like. But that's only one part of this strategy. The other part is rigging the rules.
And by rigging the rules, we mean a very clever and extensive campaign to make it, for example, harder for people to vote through such things as a voter ID, knowing that the people who would be most hurt by this, most limited by it in terms of getting to the polls and having their voices heard, are low-income people and people of color, precisely the people most damaged by the mindset of anti-government and pro this mythical free market where our fate is determined by it alone. So it was very smart. Part of this had to do with redistricting, very serious efforts to gerrymander, that's now a commonly known term, to draw the lines every 10 years at census time, lines of our districts, our voting districts are redrawn, can be redrawn, and it can determine that indeed the party who has the power can shift it so that the others cannot have their voices fully heard, and that's been happening in a number of places.
We're talking with Francis Moore-Lepay and Adam Eichen about their book, Daring Democracy.
And the list goes on and on. Unleashing money in politics, more corporate lobbying expenditures, rigging the rules to make sure Americans don't have a voice. And so it's not a surprise we're in a place right now where two political scientists did the math and determined that the average American has near zero influence in our politics, while those with money have, quote, significant influence.
And one of the big shockers for us in this is that how much of this is happening outside of the party structure. So it's pretty invisible. The Koch brothers, for example, their network, many people now know the term Koch brothers, very wealthy billionaires who are very extreme in their views in terms of pro-market, anti-government. Well, 70% of, let me just say, 70% of resources on the right now are outside of political parties, and the Koch brothers network constitutes maybe more than three times the staff of the Republican Party, if you include the national and the congressional arm. So that is huge. And so this was part of the lack of accountability, too, to this manipulation of the mindset and the rigging of the rules. It's really very frightening.
And we also know that it's about to get even worse. Citizens United 2.0, you can call it, is now being proposed by the Trump administration. That's the repeal of the Johnson Amendment that some say would mean more than $1 billion per election cycle in secret tax-deductible campaign contributions from religious organizations and other 501c3s. So as you point out, you know, we have like less than 1% of influence. And yet it seems that elections is the only place that, you know, is one of the few places that we are told that we have a voice. First of all, what's your thought on this, given that the 2018 elections are coming up? And what are the ways in which we can, in time for that, or at least in time for 2020, make our electoral voice stronger?
Well, I'm so glad you brought up the Johnson Amendment, because really keeping that in place is so, you know, fundamentally important. And that's been a big part of the democracy movement thus far during the Trump administration, is to make sure they don't repeal that, which would unleash, potentially $1 billion in spending from religious organizations and 501c3s, nonprofits. But, you know, going into 2018, we have to make this an issue. We have to make sure that every candidate not only expresses their support for campaign finance reform and voting rights, but also holding them to it. And I think one of the best examples of this is March on Harrisburg in Pennsylvania, rather. And they've been going around and lobbying all the state politicians and really making sure that democracy reform is on the agenda, that no politician can avoid their responsibility to cleaning up the system. And we know this is the case, whether you're Republican or Democrat, right? Bernie Sanders said the system is rigged, and Donald Trump said he wanted to drain the swamp. So we know we have the support here, but it's about mobilizing people to make their voice heard going into 2018.
And one of the things we like to emphasize in the book is that so much is happening that people don't know about, that we love to share in our book. So much is happening for the good, for democracy. For example, in the last federal election, while a lot of us were really disappointed at the presidential outcome, that there were 17 state initiatives, state and local initiatives at that time, that of them, 14 passed that have to do with democracy, furthering democracy.
And I mean, this is the key claim of our book. I mean, if there's one thing that we want your listeners to take away, it's that there is an emerging democracy movement across the United States. You know, as I said earlier, we just came from this Unrig the System conference in New Orleans, where every single state was represented. There were activists fighting for democracy from every state at this conference. And, you know, there is a democracy movement. It is a movement of movements that people are realizing that they will never make progress on their issue passions if they don't also fight for democracy itself. And one of our favorite organizations is called Democracy Initiative. And it's basically a coalition of 63 of the top issue advocacy organizations in the country. And they came together in about 2013, 2014, and said, you know what, we need to pool our resources and fight for democracy too. This includes the Sierra Club, the NAACP, the Communication Workers of America. And they came together, and now their coalition represents over 30 million Americans, and they're winning across the country. And we see this in every state. There are activists who are really doing the work and winning. And so my advice is to find an organization. We just created something called the Field Guide to the Democracy Movement, or we just relaunched it. We talked about this the last time we were on your show. And we encourage your listeners to go. It's called fieldguidetodemocracy.org. And you can find a campaign in your state. We have one campaign in every state already, at least one. You can hop in and join right now, because that's the key moving into 2018. It's not just about electing candidates, but it's about growing this, you know, multi-partisan, multi-issue, cross-generation movement, and making it so that it can really realize its power, the uniting Americans across all issues and passions and ideologies, because this is the fundamental issue of our time.
Give us some examples of what the democracy initiatives are, you know, in different states, and also what the Unrigging the System?
Yeah, mm-hmm. Unrig the System.
What that platform is. Give us some, you know, just some of the details of that.
Well, one of the examples we cite in the book, that a story that we love, is the leadership in Maine that, against all odds, in 1996, Mainers came together to get money out of politics, to have clean elections so you could run for office without backing of big private interests. And funny that they wanted to hire a polling firm to tell them what chances that they had for success with this campaign. It was a ballot initiative. And the polling company said, sorry, but it would be unethical for us to take your money because you have no chance of winning. Well, they won. And in 2000, they began with a system of public financing so that, for example, our friend Deb Simpson, a waitress in Auburn, Maine, and a diner, she could run for office because all she had to do was get $5 from 50 people saying, yes, Deb, you're a viable candidate. And then she qualified for public financing and ran a terrific campaign, was reelected 4 times, a stellar legislator. And now Maine has the largest percentage of working class people in its legislature compared to any other state. So that kind of thing that very few people in America really know about, what happens then when you can get money out?
Yeah, and you see this again across the country. I mean, whether it's Democracy Initiative or a group like Represent Us, they're fighting at the state level. And I'll shout out Represent Us for a second. You know, they had this idea to help support a group of South Dakotans who wanted to reform their election system. And South Dakota in 2016, on Election Day, passed an initiative or a ballot initiative that was one of the most radical and sweeping pieces of anti-corruption legislation ever passed in this country. And it required an enormous mobilizing across progressive and conservative lines. I mean, how else are you going to pass it in a state like South Dakota, where they voted for a Republican candidate in 80% of all statewide elections in its history? And they passed it. They proved that this is not a Republican or Democrat issue. This is an American issue. And of course, the legislature, about 2 months afterwards, repealed the Citizens Initiative. They repealed it and said, no, you can't clean up the system like this. But then activists didn't give up. The South Dakotans are now fighting to put it back on the ballot to change the Constitution so the legislature cannot override it. So South Dakota is but one example of this success. And you see it across, you know, across the states, that people are being innovative in their approaches. In New Hampshire, for example, there's a movement for citizen dollars, so that if it passed, that citizens would be given, all valid voters would be given a small amount of money to give to the candidates that they approve of. I mean, in terms of democratizing political funding, it would be a huge step. And it's based off the Seattle model, which just had enormous returns, that every citizen or every voting member in Seattle got four $25 vouchers to give to eligible politicians. And the results are stunning. I mean, we know what works here and people are fighting for it.
Adam Eichen. We're speaking with him and with his co-author, Francis Moore LaPay, about their book, Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. Stay tuned for more of our conversation after the break. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. We're talking today about the pro-democracy movement in the U.S. Our guests are Francis Moore LaPay and Adam Eichen of the Small Planet Institute. The book they've co-authored is Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. Just before the break, Adam Eichen was giving some examples of grassroots pro-democracy successes in different states. Here's Francis Moore LaPay with more.
And another example of how fast things can change is that Oregon stepped up with leadership for automatic voter registration in 2015. And what happened, it means that within the first 3 months of automatic voter registration, there was a tripling of the numbers of people actually registered. That kind of makes sense, right? Voter turnout increased significantly. And then within just a few years now, 9 other states, District of Columbia, have come on board and increased their ease at which we can all vote, which is fundamental to democracy. So that's really lightning speed in social change.
And the only way very quickly that these things pass is when organizations come together. And that means, well, you know, the Sierra Club coming together with the NAACP, coming together with Common Cause. But it also means a group like Take Back Our Republic, which is founded by John Putner, who ran the insurgent Tea Party campaign against Eric Cantor, the former Republican majority whip, in 2014 or 2013. The Tea Party are coming together with a progressive organization in the state. That's the only way we pass this stuff, because, again, we know that 85% of Americans want fundamental change in the way we fund our elections. And the only way we actually realize that force, this supermajority force, is if we come together. And the Unrig the System Summit was exactly that, where you have Tea Partiers, you know, conservatives, progressives, liberals coming together in one conference in New Orleans to start planning how do we work together. Because sometimes the only way to do that is actually to come face to face. And you may not agree with people, you know, on 60%, 70%, 80% of other issues. But as long as we all believe in our democratic system, there is tremendous potential to start organizing across all divides.
Hearing you talk, it really gives me hope. But there are also tremendous challenges. I mean, for example, I really fear that we have such an entrenched oligarchy that they'll do whatever it takes to keep their grip on power. Since Trump's election, we've seen a lot of the signs of the institutional erosion of democracy. What's your thought on the challenges and how we can deal with them?
Well, I think that everything that Adam just said about a movement of movements, this is key. This is the first time in my life that people are coming together across issues so that we are speaking to the heart and soul of people, that their daily bread and butter issues are included in the democracy challenge. So I think the most important thing we can do today is to join this movement of movements where people, instead of just feeling hopeless, I think people give in to autocratic structures, people give in to authoritarianism when they feel despairing, when they feel there's no other pathway. This movement of movements, we build on this listening to people's pain, that this is both an economic and a political movement that has to move together. So I think this is the key, so that people don't feel isolated, because that's when they give in to authoritarianism.
Yeah, and you know, also we already know that the elite class is extremely worried by this democracy movement. And this is when the democracy movement is completely unknown. Right. So even when it's not even in popular language that there is a democracy movement, even though no one in media is talking about this, they're still extremely worried by it because they're resisting the movement at every step. In California, when California passes they've tried for six to seven years to pass one of the kind of most sweeping pieces of disclosure legislation after Citizens United. Every year, this big moneyed interest coalition pushes against them. And it took 7 years, but this year they passed it. And it proved that the only way to do it is by popular mobilization. And even, you know, even the strongest of big money forces in California couldn't stop it. And you see it in state after state after state. And you know they're going to try until the very end to stop it. But we also know that their power only goes so far, and that a cross-issue movement of movements is enough to push back. And it's a scary time, yes. But this is why we take pains to highlight the successes, because people only see the failures. But we have to be comfortable in that contradiction that, yes, things are bad. Yes, we lose a lot of the time, but there are wins. There are signs of hope. There are many cases where big money interests haven't been able to prevent the democracy movement from pushing real transformative legislation, whether in Maine with public financing, Seattle with the voucher system, California with the disclosure legislation, South Dakota with the anti-corruption legislation. The list goes on and on and on. And even in a state like Connecticut, where I'm currently registered to vote and my parents live, and you know that's where I spend a lot of time, you know, they tried to get rid of the public financing system there, but Citizens, you know, stood up and said no. No, you can't take away the system, and we will make sure that anybody who votes against it will suffer in the upcoming elections. And the politicians immediately said, okay, you know what? We're not going to even try to repeal this. And they've tried multiple times now, but every single time, Citizens have stepped up and made sure to protect their democracy. And if that doesn't give you hope, if that doesn't give you a sense of the power of this grassroots movement of movements, this democracy movement, then you know, you're not watching, you're not looking, because it's there. We just have to really put our magnifying glass, you know, over, you know, to cut through the discourse of that, you know, of Trump, and really focus on those moments where this democracy movement is really seeing success.
Well, that's terrific. And so is your book, Daring Democracy, Igniting Power, Meaning, and Connection for the America We Want. Francis Moore-Lappe and Adam Eichen, thank you so much for this really inspiring interview.
Thank you. It was my great pleasure.
We're so happy to be back, and thanks so much.
Go to writersvoice.net to read an excerpt from Daring Democracy. After that conversation with Adam Eichen and Francis Moore-Lappe, Eichen told me he was about to go to Pennsylvania to help promote a pro-democracy, anti-corruption initiative called the March on Harrisburg. We decided I would check back with him in several weeks. Stay tuned after the break to hear that update. Welcome back to Writer's Voice. I'm Francesca Rhiannon. A few weeks after I spoke with Adam Eichen and Francis Moore-Lappe about their book Daring Democracy, I called Eichen up on Skype to find out about the March on Harrisburg, a pro-democracy, anti-corruption initiative he was helping to promote in Pennsylvania. Eichen was joined on Skype by one of the leaders of the March on Harrisburg, Rabbi Michael Pollack. I started out by asking them to tell us what the march is all about. Pollack spoke first.
March on Harrisburg is a nonpartisan, volunteer-driven, statewide organization dedicated to healing our wounded democracy and to restoring trust in the Commonwealth of Pennsylvania. Our long-term goal is to move Pennsylvania from the 45th most corrupt state in the Union into the top 10. And to do that, we need to pass about 20 bills, and we've started with a gift ban, which would make it illegal for lobbyists to give unlimited anything to our state legislators, and a bill to end gerrymandering. And to accomplish these goals, to move these bills, we lobby, we march, and we do nonviolent civil disobedience.
Well, that's great. Now, when you say you want to move it, you want to move it from 45th place in terms of democracy to the top 10 in terms of democracy. Is that right?
Absolutely. According to the Electoral Integrity Project of 2016, we are near the bottom in almost every category of democracy and corruption.
And so what are some of those categories?
Yes, so we're one of 10 states in which you are allowed to legally gift anything to any legislator. So we have lobbyists who come in and give brand new cars to legislators. They're allowed to literally give them cash. They take them to the Super Bowl. They just wine and dine them endlessly. And so we want to make that illegal. That's one of our more shameful features of Harrisburg politics. Another thing is gerrymandering. We're near the bottom in that as well. Depending on who you ask, we're 47th, 48th, or 49th in the country. And we want to end our practice of gerrymandering by taking the power of redistricting away from politicians and put it in the hands of an independent, nonpartisan commission.
And so just before I get back to you, Adam, just a little bit more about the gerrymandering. Very recently, it was the Supreme Court, I guess the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, is that right, that decided that the gerrymandering was partisan in favor of Republicans, and it suggested a different kind of map. Tell us, what's your response to the action of the Pennsylvania Supreme Court, and do you think it goes far enough in correcting gerrymandering?
We're very happy with what the Supreme Court decided, and what it decided, its decision really only affects the congressional map for 2018, possibly. It's still actually being fought out right now. The Republican leadership's latest move is to try to impeach the state Supreme Court, so we're still seeing how that's all shaking out. But what this decision will affect likely is the maps for this year and then the congressional map for 2020. But it doesn't actually fix the process, because for 2022 and beyond, we'll still have politicians making the maps. And so what will happen is they'll make a map as gerrymandered as they think possible. We'll sue them. We'll change the map. They'll make a new one. We'll sue it again. And this will just go back and forth forever. And so what we want to do is pass a constitutional amendment. And we need to pass it by June 30th, or else it won't take effect for the next round of redistricting in 2021. And this amendment would create an independent commission so that we can change the process by which we draw our maps and not just rely on the courts to step in and give us something slightly better but still not ideal.
And so, Adam, what have you been seeing as you've been accompanying Michael Pollack around the state about the response to this proposed change in the gerrymandering process?
Well, I mean, what I've seen so far going across Pennsylvania is pretty stunning. And namely, I'm talking about just the enthusiasm for reform. People are disgusted with how gerrymandered Pennsylvania was, and they're recognizing that, you know, the Supreme Court decision isn't enough. And people are ready to fight to make a difference here, to change the process, both with gerrymandering and with the gift ban. The people are really alienated. They're disgusted with politics in Harrisburg. And, you know, at our event the other day in York, Pennsylvania, was someone wearing a shirt for Scott Wagner for governor shirt. And Scott Wagner, he's running for governor, and he's extremely right-wing. And this woman was here with that shirt supporting Scott Wagner, and she was nodding her head for everything that we said. So it really is proving to me everything that we wrote about in Daring Democracy, which is this issue really does cut across partisan divide. And that's exciting. It's exciting to go into a place like Pennsylvania and see just how much the message of March on Harrisburg resonates.
Now, so what are some of the other proposals that the March on Harrisburg is making to improve Pennsylvania's status from being 45th in the country to in the top 10 in terms of democratic reforms?
So we're starting with the gift ban and the bill to end gerrymandering, and then we're just going to move down the line of a long list of democracy reforms. So we're looking next at automatic voter registration, and then we need to tackle private campaign finance reform in Pennsylvania. We have no limits on private campaign contributions on state-level races here. And then we want to move into public campaign financing, and then just a whole wave of things to open up the ballot. More polling places, making Election Day a holiday, absentee ballot reform, moving toward paper ballots or some other form of accountable ballot counting. And really, there's just a whole list of things, like minor changes that we need to make to our democratic process to open it up and to really reconnect people with government.
And March on Harrisburg is also working with people in Philadelphia to pass public financing of elections for city council races, which would be a major win, too. And this is on the heels of Washington, D.C. passing public financing for city council races. So we're looking to really push the goalposts in terms of city politics, too.
And wherever we are in the state, we're always encouraging people at the most local levels to pass gift bans, to pass bills that would really open up democracy. And we've seen a few of these really, really local bills getting passed, which is very encouraging. There's a groundswell of support in the state.
Now, talk about how the movement that you're building in Pennsylvania can be a model for other states.
Absolutely. So what we've constructed can be exported anywhere. And we entered into a partnership with Represent Us, a national good government group. And in this partnership, we are producing our model, our playbook, and then they're going to help us export it to other states, to all the states that do not have a ballot initiative process. Because what we specialize in is dealing with a hostile legislature. And any legislature out there right now that hasn't already passed these reforms is going to be resistant to change because people aren't quick to vote against their own corrupt practices. And so we are very, very excited to get this out to other states so that we can have a march on Albany and a march on Trenton and a march on Columbus and march on Annapolis and march on Richmond and just down the line.
And then the goal here really to kind of outline the playbook is it requires intense lobbying, citizen lobbying. I mean, let's be clear that March on Harrisburg, they've met with 240 out of the 253 legislators in the state capitol. That way, you know, everyone in the Capitol building knows who March on Harrisburg is. They've done their due diligence. They know who's in support, who needs to be swayed. And then they do a long march, you know, to show commitment, to get press coverage. You know, we did that march together, actually. I came down right after I finished Daring Democracy, you know, I joined Michael and his team to march from Philadelphia to Harrisburg. It was 100 miles, and it took about 10 days. And then they engage in nonviolent civil disobedience, to raise the issue, to force the encounter, to force the politicians to make a choice, to either clean up their practices or arrest the citizens who want to try and clean up politics.
And so it sounds like you have quite a hostile legislature there, since they're going to try to impeach the Supreme Court judges who adjusted this. And by the way, I saw something that showed that the court-drawn map still favors the GOP, but less so. So it's difficult to understand why the Republicans are trying to impeach them. What is your strategy for building cross-partisan support for this, and what do you feel your chances are for change?
Our chances for a change are pretty good. So for the gerrymandering bill, We just actually got a hearing on the calendar for March 27th in the Senate subcommittee where the bill sits. So that's a great step forward. We've been working on that for over a year now, and that's a very encouraging step forward. And one of the reasons why Republicans are jumping on to the gerrymandering bill right now is because they understand a few things. First thing is that they don't want the courts to have to interfere. They profess a strong belief against what they call judicial activism. And so to preempt further court involvement, now they want to solve the problem. And the second thing encouraging them is that through some weird processes here in Pennsylvania, the Democrats will actually control the state legislative maps in 2021, the maps that shape Harrisburg, the 50 state senators and the 203 state reps that we send to Harrisburg. And when you go to a Republican legislator and let them know that their district line is in the hands of the Democrats, they're kind of quick to move at that point. So we are having success with reaching across the aisle. And our gift ban bill is very bipartisan, and it's a Republican bill, a Republican-sponsored bill. And frankly, our biggest obstacle on that bill are corrupt Philadelphia Democrats.
Wow.
We've had great success reaching across the aisle because our message is so nonpartisan and it's just so basic. We like to call ourselves the marriage counselors and the divorce lawyers. And we're there just to facilitate the divorce between special interests and government, between big money and government. And we're there to re-facilitate the relationship, the marriage between voters and elected officials, and really build that trust. And so we operate a lot with metaphor. We tell a lot of stories when we lobby. And we really try to speak more to the heart than the head and really try to sway legislators.
Wow, that sounds great. So is all that going to be in your in literature that people from other states can find?
I'm working on it. I'm pushing on some deadlines, but yes, absolutely.
That's wonderful. Now, one final question. Michael Pollack, you are a rabbi, and I noticed that you are also connecting up with the Poor People's Campaign, a national call for moral revival. There have been a number of religious leaders who have been involved with these kinds of, those Moral Mondays in North Carolina. Why is this a moral issue?
A moral issue because what religion demands of us primarily is justice and peace and compassion. And when you have corruption, you have blinders put up around those in power and they cannot see anybody. So it says in Deuteronomy, do not accept a bribe because a bribe blinds the eyes of the wise and distorts the words of the righteous. Because when you have a culture of corruption, we call it a bubble sometimes. There's a bubble around D.C., there's a bubble around Harrisburg, and that's how bribery functions. It keeps information out and it kind of locks in those in power already. And when you can't see, when the eyes of the wise can't see, then they can't connect. And our entire society depends upon human connections and relationships. And if you can't see somebody, you can't relate to them and you can't serve them. So when we have a culture of corruption where there's only a few people who have a seat at the table, there are many others who can never get to the table. And I think it was Barney Frank who once said, if you don't have a seat at the table, you're probably on the menu. We need to clean up corruption so that we can really function together as a society and see each other and allow holiness to emerge from relationships.
And if I can quickly jump in here and tell a quick story about Michael that I always think speaks wonders to him, and he's surely going to give me a look right now because he hates it when I when I promote him like this. But I mean, I really just to kind of get a sense of why I dropped everything I was doing and came here to Pennsylvania for a month. I really think that this story of Michael tells everything your listeners need to know. That when I asked him, I met him right before he graduated rabbinical school. He was about 2 weeks from that. From graduation, and he took a week off to march from Philadelphia to D.C., and he was missing classes and all this stuff, and he was fielding job offers, and he turned them all down, and he turned down stable jobs at Hillel's and synagogues, and I asked why, and he said, because to me, being a spiritual leader means being a community organizer, so that's what it's all about. And for me, I think that says everything you need to know about March on Harrisburg and Michael Pollack, because they, you know, the folks here are doing it for the right reasons. They're here to clean up Harrisburg, not for self-interest, but because they really want to promote a better society. They want to really create a state that works for Pennsylvanians, and that's enough to inspire me.
Rabbi Michael Pollack of the March on Harrisburg and Adam Eichen of the Small Planet Institute, I want to thank you so much for talking with us here on Writer's Voice about this terrific work that you're doing in Pennsylvania.
Thanks so much for having me.
Rabbi Michael Pollack and Adam Eichen talking about the pro-democracy, anti-corruption initiative in Pennsylvania, the March on Harrisburg. Go to writersvoice.net to find out more about it. That's it this week for Writer's Voice. Go to writersvoice.net to listen to or download past shows, plus find out more about our guests or read book excerpts. The Writer's Voice webmaster is Bill Way. I'm your host, Francesca Rhiannon.